I've teamed up with GoCar. Let me tell you why. Ireland has more cars on the road today than we've ever had before. In fact, 750,000 households have two or more cars. That doesn't sound like the future of driving to me. Car sharing takes cars off the road. In fact, GoCar asked 4,000 of their members, if GoCar didn't exist, would you buy yourself a car? 60% of them said they would. If you want a cost-effective and convenient way to get around, download the GoCar app and discover the smarter and affordable way to move. This is Understanding Money, and I am Owen McGee. We have a great episode for you this week. This one's all about heuristics. H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-C-S. Heuristics. Basically, in simple terms, what does that mean? It's the shortcuts our brain takes in order to make decisions faster. And I have a fascinating interview coming up in a minute with Shane from the ESRI, who's a behavioural scientist. And this stuff blows my mind. I love it and I really enjoy it and it really makes me think. And I heard him on the radio last week and I reached out to him and said, I'd love to have you on the podcast. He's come on the podcast. I am excited. I can't wait for you to hear it. There's a lot to take in. Let's just jump straight into it. Let's go talk to Shane. I'm joined in studio by Shane Timmins. And Shane, you're a behavioural scientist with the ESRI. Tell us what that means, first of all.
Yeah, so as behavioural scientists, you study how and why people behave the way they do, including the things that might affect decisions. So we look at how people, things that affect people's health decisions, environmental decisions, and decisions about money.
Okay. And are you looking at it on a macro level and then making judgments about what happens to the individual? Or how does that behave? Does it work from a bottom-up point of view or a top-down point of view?
Yeah, so it depends on your approach to it. So I personally, my background is in psychology, so I take that bottom-up.
Okay.
How the individual is and the things that might affect their decisions. But we will look at kind of things that affect groups as a whole as well.
Mm. Okay. So when we're thinking about money and our behaviours, and sometimes we just think, like, yeah, I always keep it, oh, I'm crap at money, or I make really bad decisions when it comes to money. What are the type of things that are influencing our decisions, or what biases do we have? And maybe we can talk us through some of them things. But what are the kind of other factors that are involved or learned behaviours that we have that actually affect our behaviour when it comes to money?
Yeah, so a lot of how we operate psychologically comes from sort of an evolutionary perspective. So it's how things that would have helped our ancestors to survive. And they didn't necessarily have money. So there's lots of psychological heuristics that we rely on and biases that come into play that affect how we deal with money that not necessarily going to be helpful.
Okay.
So for example, some of the biases that we have identified include what's called accumulation bias.
Okay, talk me through what that means.
So accumulation bias, even when you know about it, you find it difficult to overcome. So essentially it's where we are very bad at accumulating low amounts of money over time. So essentially estimating how low amounts of money will add up over time. So for example, if someone is presented with the option of paying for their gym membership all in one go versus paying for it every month, even if you have the money available, you go with I'll go with the monthly one. It seems a bit cheaper. But you'll know if you add them all up, it's actually going to work out more expensive.
Okay. So it's a case of when we're sitting back and we're making a financial decision, break it down into smaller bits and we don't give it the same credit.
Exactly, yeah. So we tend to underestimate it by about 5 to 10%. Now, for one individual bill, that might not make too much of a difference, but if it's across multiple bills, it will add up.
Okay, and that's the same then on spending as well, because we say, oh no, I spend very little. But actually, if you're spending little and often, you're spending quite a bit.
Exactly, yeah. So all of those little individual costs, if you think you're kind of keeping track of them in your head, you're probably underestimating. Essentially, that's what accumulation bias tells us.
Okay, so and it works on both the spending and the saving side as well. And when it comes to building, what other biases have we got? What other things do we have that are affecting us on a day-to-day basis?
Well, with our finances, unfortunately, most people tend to be overconfident and optimistic. So we tend to think that we are going to be able to handle things better than we are. And particularly that comes into play when we're thinking about the future. So for example, if you think about the likelihood that you face something, a financial shock in the future, so something is going to eat into your savings, people will tend to think, no, it's fine. That's not going to come up. So we rely on what's called an availability heuristic, which is where you think about one event occurring.
Mm.
You think about the likelihood that will occur and you'll just focus on that.
Okay.
And ignoring every other.
So what, the car is going to break down in 6 months' time?
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So if you think about the car breaking down in the next 6 months, you might realistically think there's a low probability of that happening. You might also think realistically there's a low probability my washing machine breaks down. Realistically, low probability my laptop's going to break. But all of those low probabilities add up.
Yes.
So if you only focus on one of them, that availability heuristic comes in. And then you're not accumulating them properly. So there's the accumulation bias. And they both then work against you thinking that you might need to save.
I remember I had a bank manager once and I was sitting down with him and we were putting down projections for where the business is going to go and blah, blah, blah. This is when I was first starting out. Mm-hmm. And he got a great phrase. He said, I've never seen a bad set of projections on. And it's probably something similar there. Like whenever we sit down and we try to plan forward, it's very unlikely that we're going to sit down and plan all the negatives and really allow ourselves. But surely we need that as humans. We need to plan for the optimistic outcome as opposed to looking at all the negatives that could happen because we'd be miserable all the time, surely.
Yeah, of course. You would never get anything done if you were just sitting around thinking about all the fears. But where it's kind of important to be aware of these is when you're trying to plan your budget, for example. So that's the situation where you might want to factor in, okay, a few different things could go wrong. Maybe it would be better for me to have that financial buffer.
Some type of buffer. Yeah. Okay. And actually, sorry, I skipped onto that one. I'm going to ask you collectively for the two of them now. What can you do about them? How do you, like the budgeting is obviously the answer for that one and making sure that you just allow a little bit extra. You assume that when you go on holidays, you're going to spend a little bit more than you think you are. When you go out for a night out, it's going to cost a little bit more than you expected it to be. And by putting in a bit of extra onto the budget and put a bit of meat on the budget, obviously you can help to negate that second one. But what about the first one? What can you do about that?
Yeah, so it's not easy. And this is exactly the kind of stuff that we try to study. So firstly, we try to identify why it's happening and the conditions under which this bias or heuristic is coming into play. And then we try to develop interventions to try to help people to overcome them. So some that we've worked on is that if you give people calculators to play with, it can help them to kind of figure out the different costs they might need. A lot of it will come down to how communication is received. So for example, we have some work shown that if you use, we actually use communication techniques from health psychology about the risks that people might face. And we adapted those then for financial risks. So one thing that you do is instead of talking to people about probabilities, so I think nerds like me are the ones who like to hear about the probabilities. But if you break it into what's called a natural frequency, people will pay more attention to it. So a natural frequency is just that one in five people will face this.
Okay, instead of saying 20% of people.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. That makes people pay a lot more attention to it. So for example, on the savings front, we did some research showing that about 60% of people will face a financial shock in a year.
In any given year?
In any given year.
Okay.
So that's data that we collected.
I'm sorry, just before we go on, what's a financial shock? Is that like a washing machine breaking down or is that...
Yeah.
Okay.
So anything unexpected that comes up, anything that you might be using your rainy day fund for.
Okay.
That's a financial shock. It's something that you didn't expect.
So 60% of people, and for anyone who listens to podcasts, I know I use the word buffer all the time. So 60% of people will dip into their buffer in any given year.
Yeah.
Okay.
If they have one.
If they have one, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I should probably use my own techniques here for it. 3 in 5 people will face a financial shock in any given year. And we found that presenting people with that information, we use infographics for it to kind of get that stat really across to people, that they were more likely then to open up a savings account, that they were more motivated then to save because we'd kind of overcome that focus on just one thing going wrong and the underestimation and so on.
Okay. It's interesting because that 60% versus 3 out of 5, that makes a lot of sense. Like there's one stat that comes at me and it just resonates with me a lot. Like 33% of people standing in the schoolyard in September will have borrowed money to get the kids back to school, right? That was last year's figures, so they might be different this year. But if you change that into when you're standing in the schoolyard and you look around at the two people next to you, if you haven't borrowed money to get the kids back to school, the likelihood is one of the other two people next to you has. And it just makes it much more real.
Yeah.
And I'm a numbers guy and stats and I can understand them and comprehend them very quickly. But I just think that the 1 in 5 or the 1 in 10 or the 3 in 5 just makes it much more easy to understand and makes it real because you're now thinking of people instead of a percentage.
And that's it exactly. So back to what I was saying about our psychology developing from an evolutionary perspective. We didn't evolve to deal with statistics.
Yeah.
We evolved to deal with other people. So when you
did you evolve different
people,
to us then? Did you?
No. This is just a pure nerdy interest that takes me down one route. But that's it.
So when you think about it then, there's a couple of other biases that I would consider. And like the confirmation bias is one that I always find interesting. So I always explain that is if you buy a red car, you see loads of red cars in the road to confirm to yourself that this was the right decision to make because everyone loves red cars. But how does that affect us on a day-to-day spending basis? Because it's really easy to see it with the big stuff, like you buy a share in XYZ company and now every time you scan through Google, you're only seeing positive stories because you're ignoring the negative ones. But on a day-to-day spending basis, how does something like confirmation bias affect us?
Yeah, so confirmation bias is, it's essentially where you look for information to support where you already are. So if, for example, you've decided that I don't need to save right now, you will then look for feedback and information, like someone tells you that, like, oh, I've decided I'm not going to start saving until next year. You think, oh, someone else is like me. I agree with them. If, on the other hand, they were to say, like, oh, it's important to start saving now, you might underweight that. There's something, they're just too worried about things. They're too pessimistic. So you start to overweight information that confirms your existing belief. And it's related to what's called motivated reasoning. And that's where we will just tend to ignore any information that comes in and goes against our opinion. So you see that a lot in the political sphere, but it also then affects our finances. So if, for example, you want to start putting money away, but then tickets come up that there's a concert you really want to go to, and you think, oh yeah, no, that's I'd prefer to spend my money on that. You will then start to create a narrative that further supports your decision that you've made.
Which is really interesting because when I'm dealing with a couple, right, I can often have a couple who is one of them's really worried about the long-term future. And how am I going to put bread and milk on the table at 75? And the other person in the couple is, actually, I'll be gone tomorrow. Let's just spend it today. And both, what you're telling me here is both of those couples will find stuff around them in their lives. Like the person who says, oh, we could be dead tomorrow is the person who's going to say, oh, sure, look, Jimmy, didn't he die at 62? He never seen his pension pot or whatever it is. And the other person's going to be, yeah, but my granny is 98. And this is them just looking for stuff in the world to confirm they're right.
That's exactly it. Now, people do have different risk preferences. So some people are happy to take the risk, other people would prefer not to. But exactly as you say, then you will look for narratives that support where you are rather than evaluating that information objectively. It's a difficult thing to do.
And is it enough just to be aware that confirmation bias exists and then question yourself on, am I actually taking a full rounded approach to my decision here?
So the information can help, right, but we're all still susceptible to it.
Okay, so we're screwed. In other words,
kind of screwed when it comes to it. Yeah.
Okay, so you're just kind of give me all the information, but I'm going to ignore what I want to ignore anyway.
That's it. But there are ways that we can still work with our psychology to try to help us with our savings, or with not spending as much as we might want to spend.
Okay.
So, for example, another bias we have is called present bias, and that's where we tend to overweight things that are happening now in place of things that might happen in the future. And the behavioral economists will say that we do so hyperbolically. So that just means the further into the future we get, the more we devalue it.
Okay.
So essentially, if you apply that then to your day to day, your future self is worth less to you than your present self.
Yes.
And it applies across your money, it applies across your health, and so on. Mm. One way to get around that is to make pre-commitments to how you're going to deal with your money. So, for example, one study that we ran, we got people to just pre-commit in advance that they would only use their rainy day savings for things that they themselves deemed as responsible and not things that they themselves deemed as irresponsible.
Okay.
That's a way you kind of work with yourself. So you commit now to something that will happen with the future. The other thing is to take the decision out of your hands.
Yes, automate it.
Exactly.
Okay.
And as a behavioral scientist, this is what we tend to try to tell people. It's doing ourselves out of a job. Get rid of the decision.
Yes.
As much as you can. So default into it, set up that direct debit. There's research from the US showing that if you set that direct debit to automatically increase in future, you will save more and you'll barely feel it.
Yeah, there's another piece of research that is tying into the same thing. I think is, and that's why I'm asking. I think it's exactly the same thing where people in company pensions in the US, I understand, were asked, will you increase your pension contribution?
Yep.
And they said, no, I can't. Okay.
Yep.
And then they were asked, okay, the next time you get a pay rise, would you be willing to commit some of that pay rise to increasing your pension contribution, like 50% of it or 70%? And people said, oh yeah, that's fine. And they did it. And it was dramatically improved, the amount of pension pots that people had when they hit retirement. So we're talking about the same thing.
That's
there.
Exactly it. It's the Save More Tomorrow program.
And what did you call that bias? What was that?
So present bias.
Present bias. And is that the opposite or is it the same thing as recency bias? So my understanding of recency bias is it looks backwards. So if I have a fight with my partner 6 months ago, we have a fight, right? Mm. And I might be still annoyed about it now, right? I'm a bit sad if I am, right? But 6 months later, I'm can still feel it, right? But if I have the exact same fight with my partner this morning, the more recent one is going to hurt me more than the one, the exact same fight we had 6 months ago. Is that the same thing or is that an opposite thing?
And so it is related. So recency bias essentially is where you overweight the last piece of information you've heard.
Okay.
So say, for example, you are getting some information about how to deal with your finances. Mm. The primacy effect is the first thing you hear. That's when you're paying attention. That will stick with you. And then the recency bias is where the very last thing you hear, that's what I'm going to do.
Right.
So if you're presented with different options, the research shows that the last thing that you're presented with can have an undue influence.
And the first thing has a bigger influence than the rest of the stuff in the middle.
Yes, exactly. So the first piece of research that kind of showed this was all to do with how people memorize things. So if you give someone a list of things to memorize, they will do very well on the first thing you ask them. They'll do pretty well on the last thing you ask them. And then the stuff in the middle gets kind of lost.
So explain to me, I used to sell diamond rings for a big jeweler, right? And we were trained and we were really well trained. Like the training was superb. And I think it was ahead of its time because I'm old, right? And this was a long time ago. And when we had different trays in the window, and if someone came in and asked to see the engagement rings, we'd say, have you any thoughts? No, just show us your engagement rings. We were trained to go out and get the most expensive tray first, right? And then the next thing we were trained to, you know, there's none there that suits. The next thing we were trained to do was to bring out the least expensive. Mm-hmm. And then, and I assume the marketers inside didn't put the nicest ones on the least expensive tray. And then you brought out the middle tray. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a bit of anchor bias, or maybe is it primacy and recency?
Yeah, so there's a few things going on here. They probably were ahead of their time on it. So anchoring, as you say, is pretty well established now at this stage as well. So the first price you're exposed to, everything else will get compared to that. The other thing that comes into play is what's called the decoy effect.
Yes.
So the decoy effect, a classic example, comes from the cinema.
Okay.
So if people are presented with two popcorn options, there's a small one for €3, a large one for €7. You might say, oh, I'm not that hungry, I'll go with the small one. You put a middle one in there, so the medium popcorn is now €4. You will be like, oh, well, that actually is pretty good value compared to the large one. I'm going to go for the €4 medium popcorn.
Okay.
So you're spending more money for food that you don't really want, but it looks like it's better value.
And the little one was just a decoy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So that distracts you from the actual evaluation. You'll change your choice. That affects your finances.
Okay. Wow. And that now is quite common in terms of across the board, whether it's walking into a car showroom, to walking into the cinema, to walking into jewelers. I'm sure they're still doing something similar. They still exist. But it was terrible. Like, it was an awful thing when you saw how well it worked, because the anchor bias kicks in where they kind of come in, where I was planning on spending, I don't know, €4,000. Let's make up a number. You show them the €10,000 tray, you show them the €500 tray, and they end up spending six.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. And we have evidence showing that it affects people's decisions of loans in Ireland. So
okay,
we ran a study that was, it was funded by the CCPC. And in that, we looked at the online calculators that are available on different bank websites and so on. So we firstly reviewed the way the bank calculators are set up. And we noticed that for all of those, if you're going for a personal loan, the default setting on that calculator will be to repay it over 5-7 years, whatever the upper end of it is. But if you go on to the more impartial websites, the price comparison tools, they tended to have them set at the bottom end of the of that scale.
Right.
We had a look at this and we're like, okay, there seems to be a fairly kind of consistent pattern here, not just in Ireland, it was kind of across the board, any kind of English speaking website that we could find. We had a look at it. We then tested what happens to people's decisions when they're comparing loans. If that anchor, so that initial setting is at that upper end of the scale, people will choose longer loan repayment terms than if it's at the lower one.
Okay.
So we don't know exactly why it's happened, but we think it's because people are then using that initial setting as the anchor for their judgment. So they're going to compare everything else against it, and everything is going to look a bit cheaper. So that 3-year loan is going to look cheaper if I compare it to the 5-year one than if I'm comparing it to the 1-year one.
And of course, the bank are doing that because the longer the term, the more interest that they're going to get from it.
Well, it would make sense on their end to do it that way, yeah.
Wow. It's interesting because I remember years ago working in a bank, and they, this is a very long time ago, one of the things they did with their life cover sales was life cover for your mortgage, let's say. You have to take out life cover for your mortgage. And say the life cover was €43 a month. They trained the financial advisors up to say that's a tenner a week. Okay. And it's the same thing there, is it? Tenner a week, which is there's 4.33 weeks in a month. So that's £43 a month. The interesting thing was people would say, oh, yeah, no, I'll do that. That's fine. But you couldn't pay it by the week. Mm-hmm. You could only do the direct debit by the month. But that didn't seem to matter at that stage.
Yeah.
You've made the decision.
Yeah. So that's in behavioral economics, that pennies a day effect,
right,
is what it's called.
Explain that to me then.
So pennies a day effect, it's your kind of standard marketing technique where, like your life insurance, that it's only 10 euro a week. You'll hear products marketed as, oh, for less than the price of a cup of coffee a week, or for just 1 euro a day, you can get XYZ. Research shows that when products are framed that way, when the price of products are framed that way, people tend to overvalue them. So they'll value them more than if they just see the total cost.
Okay.
That also affects how, if you're buying something online, the separation of the different features of the price come into play. So, for example, you might have a surcharge that's separate from the product price, that's separate from the shipping fee, or you might have a cleaning fee associated with accommodation that you're booking that's separate from the service fee and so
on.
Or
you might have an airline ticket plus a seat, picking your seat, plus bringing the bag, by separating them off.
So if you separate them out, people actually think that the value is greater overall. So essentially that they'll underestimate the total cost.
Okay.
So that gets into our pennies a day effect, and now that can work against you. So with bills and so on, like you said, the life insurance, with your gym membership. So if you're going for the monthly one over the annual one, it tends to cost you more. People are usually a bit aware that it'll cost you more, but we underestimate how much more it's going to cost you. So that works against us with spending, but it can also, we can use it then to work with us in saving. So you might be familiar with a few years ago, there's the 1p challenge. So that would save
one penny today, two pennies tomorrow. Yeah,
exactly. And because of accumulation bias, so we're poor at adding things up over time, people are genuinely surprised to hear that over the course of the year, you'll save nearly 700 euro by just saving a penny extra every day.
Yeah. Is it a penny extra every day to get to 700? Is it a penny today, 2p, 3p? Or is it a penny today, 2p, 4p the next day?
No, it's 8p. Just 1p extra a day.
Okay.
Yeah. So on the last day, you're saving 3 euro 65.
Right.
But you'll have accumulated 670 euro.
Wow. Okay,
exactly.
That's maths I've never done. I've done it the other way, where you ask someone, I'll give you, I can't remember what the lump of money is now, I'll give you a lump of money now today, or else, and let's say it's £1 million, right? And it's a big number.
Yeah.
You might know the number. Or else I'll give you a penny today, I'll give you 2p tomorrow,
yes,
I'll give you 4p the next day, 8p today.
Yeah.
And if we should be talking in cents, but we're talking about the same thing. And people will opt for the big chunk of cash at the start. But if they took the doubled amount each day for 30 days, they would be much better off financially.
Yes. So that's the other part that works against us. So there's nothing but our psychology working against us here. So accumulation bias is that one penny extra every day.
Yeah.
Exponential growth bias is the other one. So this is where we are really, really bad at estimating exponential growth. So when the growth of something will just kind of increase at rates that we just can't comprehend. So, for example, if you think about things going viral on social media, so if I share a video and 10 of my friends share it, and then for each of those, 10 of their friends share it, you ask people, how long is that going to take to reach 10 million shares? People are like, well, 10 million, that's going to take a while. It'll take a week.
Right.
So 10 people each sharing it, 10 million shares over the space of a week, that's the kind of thing they're like, no, that can't be right.
But
that's how the maths works out. And that works against us then with our finances, particularly when compound interest comes into play. So when we're dealing with interest rates being applied to either our savings and our borrowings, we're very bad at estimating it. Even when you know about it, so I know, I've done studies on this, I know about it, I will try to correct it if I'm presented with it, I will still get it wrong. So even if I know I'm underestimating it and I try to adjust for that, I will still underestimate it.
Wow. Do you have any research that shows you the effect that it had? You know, when a credit card statement comes out and it says pay the 2% minimum or the 5% minimum, you know the way now they have to put in, if you pay the minimum, it's going to take you 13 years to pay the money back. Do you know if that has had, and I'm putting you on the spot, has that had any effect, or why was that introduced? What was it to try and improve it, and was there any research behind why they introduced it?
So I don't know if it's had any effect, but I do know why it was introduced.
Okay.
So behavioral economist called Neil Stewart at Warwick, I believe he's at Warwick now, they ran a study showing that if you present people with the minimum necessary payment on their credit card bill, that anchors them.
Yes.
So back to that anchoring bias. And they're more likely to just pay that minimum. And then over the long term, it's going to cost them more. When there's no minimum repayment on it, people will actually pay off more.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because people are coming at it kind of in an unbiased way. They're not anchored and not using it as a reference point. Now, obviously, for legal reasons and on the bank side, they have that minimum repayment and there's fees. So that needs to be communicated with people. So that statement on it, pointing out how long it's going to take them to repay it if they just pay the minimum, that's trying to counteract that.
So they have to put it in. But it's like, I was only doing figures recently for something on radio, and it was like 13.4 years or 13 and a half years if you pay the minimum amount. Yep. And it's horrendous. And people don't realize just how long it's going to take.
Yep.
And then sometimes I'm talking to people and they'll say, oh no, my credit card's really cheap. They only ask me for X amount per month, and that's the minimum payment. Yeah. And people can get caught out really badly. We absolutely could keep going all day because I love this stuff, and you present it in such a way that makes it really understanding, and I really appreciate that. I'm going to give a kind of random non-one. I heard you. The reason why I reached out to you because I heard you on the radio last week. One of the things I found fascinating was that you said on the radio that when you colour the cycle lanes in red, it's less likely a car is going to verge across on top of them. That statistically it's not. But the reason that's a segue into, of all the mad things you've learned from behavioral science perspective, what's the one that sticks out in your head that just goes, that just, I can't get my head around that and why it works?
Oh, yeah. Great question. One of them that always impresses me is findings from social pressure. We know what kind of why it works, but it always impresses me. So there's research shown that if you put a group of 10 people in a room and you present them with something that they look at that is completely factual, so it's how long do you think this line is, or there's two lines, and like, which of these lines do you think is longer? The studies that have been done, they put one participant is in there and everyone else is on the experimenter side.
Right.
Right? So it's a complete setup.
Okay.
One person comes in from the public and they're maybe fourth to say their opinion. Everyone else is going to say the one that is objectively longer is the shorter one.
So they're going to, 9 people are going to give the wrong answer.
Exactly.
And see how the one tester,
see how that one
person is going to react.
Exactly. And the vast majority of the people will go with the wrong answer. It is plain in front of their eyes, but because of that social pressure, because of that they don't want to seem like they're seeing things in a different way, they'll conform.
There's a similar study to that where they have a waiting room. I've seen it on YouTube or wherever I've seen it. They have a waiting room and you have 9 people who are in on it and one person who walks in and is being tested.
Yep.
And they fill the room with smoke and the fire alarm starts going off. And the 9 just sit there, keep reading their papers and don't do anything. And the 10th person just stands there in what they believe to be a burning building.
That's it.
That's the same.
It.
And what's that? Is that a bias? Or is that a behavioural? Is there a name for that? What that behaviour is?
It's got a conformity. So it's just social conformity, social pressure, social norms. All of these things impact on our behaviours in ways that we really like to think it wouldn't.
And if you take that from a finance perspective, because if it's a finance podcast, if you see the Joneses with a new car.
Exactly.
Yes. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
That was incredibly interesting. I really appreciate you coming in and sharing your expertise with us. There's no doubt we're going to be looking for you again at some stage. So when we want someone back in, we always get them to commit on air that they will be back if I need it.
You're working with my psychology there. Pre-committing me to do it in the future.
That's exactly what it is. Actually, one very last question.
Yeah.
Is there a book that the layperson can read on this stuff? If you had to pick out one book and said, oh yeah, this is a great whistle-stop tour of all this stuff, what book would it be?
One that I've really enjoyed recently is it's called The Invisible Gorilla.
Okay.
So it's related to work that was done. It's all kind of perceptual research. You might have seen the YouTube video where the gorilla walks across the screen, but people are asked to count how many. There's basketball players passing a ball to each other. You're asked to count how many passes the player is taking. And during that, a gorilla walks across the screen.
Okay.
People are asked afterwards, oh, did you notice anything about that? No.
They didn't even notice the gorilla.
And then they see the gorilla afterwards and they're like, there's no way that's the same video. I did not see that gorilla. So it's all about kind of attention and the things that kind of draw our attention and how it can be manipulated and so on.
The invisible gorilla.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Sarah, you've joined us again and we've got some questions this week. These are all about spending habits, obviously.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so the first one is definitely to do with spending habits and attitude towards money. And then the second one is a little bit different, but sure, we can have a listen, see what you think.
Let's jump straight in, so.
Hi, Owen. Happy New Year to you. Hope you had a lovely Christmas. I'm just wondering, I am single and I just got mortgage approval, which is great, but I have this anxiety over spending my hard-earned deposit and lump sum that I have in the bank. And now that I have the mortgage and when I buy a house, I won't be able to save nearly anywhere near as much, obviously, because it'll be going out on the mortgage payments per month. So, yeah, I don't like not having that buffer, I suppose, of the lump sum of savings, but I'm going to have to use it in order to get the house. So how do I overcome that? Thank you.
What do you think of that?
I'd say this is a question everybody has when they're about to just empty their accounts, basically.
Yeah, empty their accounts on a deposit, or even if it's less savings and it's on holiday or whatever else. Yeah. We do create an emotional attachment with money.
Yeah.
And particularly if you were not saving for years and then all of a sudden you save and you see it building and they go, and it can become a little bit addictive in a positive way that you save, provided you're not taking away too much from today and you're saving within your means, which kind of sounds like a strange thing to say. But unfortunately, this cure for it is, it's twofold. First of all, you shouldn't, even when you're buying a house, if at all possible, don't wipe yourself out completely. Because the problem with it is everyone underestimates, when you're buying a house or an apartment, it doesn't matter, if you're buying a property, everyone underestimates the cost of moving in.
Yeah.
And people remember the big stuff like the sofa and the TV and the cooker.
The pots and pans.
Yeah. And even the first big shop.
Yeah.
Like, you're walking, if you're moving out from home, you're walking out of a house that has like
bleach. My mum always talks about their first shop. My mum and dad did together when they moved in.
Yeah.
And they were like straight to the crisp aisle. Like they were like kids again. They spent so much money on like not stuff that stays in your cupboard, nothing that you need long term.
Yeah, and it does. People completely underestimate it. And what can be really scary there is you wipe your savings out on the deposit and the solicitor and everything else, and then you discover, oh, I really have to fit this house out.
Yeah,
with the big stuff and the little stuff.
Yeah,
and you end up with credit union loans or credit cards or overdrafts or all of the above. And what I would say the cure for that person there who has that emotional attachment, first of all, they should accept that they have succeeded. Yeah. They're single, they've got a mortgage and they've got the deposit.
Yeah.
That's next or near impossible at the moment. It's really, really hard to achieve. In fact, I had stuff, we're recording this on a Monday, yesterday in the Sunday Independent, I had a piece that basically said the average earner, not even the average earner, if someone's making 20% more than the average wage, and they're paying average rent, and they're spending the average spending, what the banks say you should be spending on your life, they've about 250 quid a month spare, and it will take them 15.4 years to save the deposit for the average house.
Yeah.
And that's a hard slog. And it's understandable that you'd be looking at your savings, going, oh, I'm going to wipe this out now.
Yeah.
But you're wiping it out for the reason why you created it.
Exactly.
And if you don't wipe yourself out completely, you will still have that buffer and you will still be able to. But this is progression and this is what you're trying to achieve with life.
Yeah.
From a financial perspective. Okay. So you just have to bite the bullet and try not to wipe yourself out completely. That answer that question fair?
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
Let's give us another one.
Hi, Alan and team. I have a question just around saving for your buffer, if you could help clarify. So I suppose a bit of background, myself and my husband, you know, we've been saving over the last few years, but our savings have kind of taken a backseat. We bought our house in 2018 and we got married in 22 and we had our baby in 2022 as well. We're just looking to build back up our savings, I suppose, especially our salary buffer, which is going to be 3 to 6 months. So we're looking at a goal of 50k overall. And the question is, because we don't particularly plan on using that money for a long time, where should that money be saved to? Should we be putting that into a 60-40 fund? Should we be leaving it in a bank account just for a rainy day? And if you could clarify that for us, it would be great. Really love the podcast. Thank you.
I prefer not to go back over that, but do you pick up there that she's saying she needs to save 3 to 6 months salary for her buffer and that's going to be 50 grand? Is that what she said?
Yeah, that's their goal.
Okay, so buffer 3 to 6 months salary. The idea here would be that if you've got stable job and two incomes, stable jobs, it's 3 months. If you've got very unsteady income, like you're a freelancer or you're working for yourself and your income's a bit dramatic and both of you, or maybe there's only one of the two of you working, then you need 6 months. And you need to decide yourselves before what that is. It sounds like they've achieved a lot in the last couple of years. They've bought a house, they've got married, they've had a child. There's a lot of drains on their finances over the last few years.
Yeah.
And they're still in a position to be able to save. So that would suggest to me that 3 months is probably closer to what they need.
Yeah.
Now, I can't be sure because I'm not looking at their finances. But once they get above the 3 months, anything they have in excess of that, that they're not going to use in the next 5 years needs to go into a 60-40.
Okay.
Okay. Having a financial buffer, and particularly one at that level, because they're obviously on decent wages, that could be, their wages could be anywhere between kind of 15 grand a month after tax and 10 grand a month after tax, somewhere in and around there is what we could be looking at. Having a financial buffer of say 30 grand, let's say they're on 10 grand a month after tax combined, having a financial buffer of 30 grand sitting there is an absolute privilege from a financial perspective.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make financial sense really when you think about it from a, am I getting any interest on this?
Yeah.
Where it makes sense is it is your financial security blanket and it keeps you there and it lets you sleep at night and it stops you reaching from the credit card when you need to. So let's say just what I would say to that person is 3 months. And anything above that goes into 60-40.
Okay.
Anything below the 3 months, just you have to put up with the crap interest rates. And that's the financial privilege they have.
Yeah.
And
so it's, keep it kind of just stable and where it is. And then anything above.
Anything above that. In a bank account, in a credit union account, depends on your own setup in terms of if you're really good and diligent, you could do it in your own current account. And you say, so I have 30 grand there. I got paid 5 grand, so I'm up to 35 grand. And I know my buffer is 30 of that 35. But other people, when I'm working with them, I'd be looking at it and saying, you know what, you need to take your buffer and you need to stick it into the credit union. I don't want you to have a card and I don't want you to have the app, right? I want you to have to get up on Saturday morning and go down to the credit union to get at it. And you will that person will know themselves what suits them, or anyone listening will know themselves what suits them.
Yeah.
It should be protected from you. You're the biggest threat to your buffer.
Yeah.
And buffers are for good things and bad things.
Yeah.
Okay. But just based on the little bit of information, I would say 3 months is enough for them to have sitting in the buffer. And I'm guessing, I'm making a lot of assumptions with that. And anything above that goes to 60-40 or something else, but if they get the advice. Does that make sense?
That all makes sense.
Okay. You're always looking for people. Tell us how people can get in touch.
So we don't
Can I just say something before you do? This is the first time that you're sitting here and you forgot to bring in the piece of paper with the number on it.
I think I can do it. We're going to need to check.
I know it. Go on, say it.
So please send some voice messages or suggestions, or if you want to be a guest yourself on the show, please get in touch on 087-295-0507.
087-291.
Oh, so close.
Yeah, 291-0507. So send your voice notes to that.
Say it one more time.
It's 087-291-0507.
Perfect.
Okay. Do send your voice notes into there, or suggestions for guests, or if you're happy to come on yourself and you want to share your story, that's where you get in touch. That's how you get in touch with the team. Sarah, thanks a million for this week.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That episode, to me, is just fantastic. It's all the things we do every day that we don't realise why we're doing them. And I know we covered some of this stuff in season one, and we've revisited it again. And I guarantee we will come back to it again, because I think every time you sit down with somebody like Shane, you learn something new from them, but you learn something new about yourself. And that is what today was all about. I'm going to be honest with you, I've just finished doing the recording with Shane, and I'm probably going to take that audio and listen to it in the car on the way home. If you feel like it, have a listen to it again. But you know what? One of the most interesting pieces of what I do when it comes to money is understanding why people do what they do. And people like Shane give us their insight into the macro research and the micro research to give us some explanations for our behaviours, good and bad. Most importantly, think about the stuff and maybe pick one or two things about what he said and apply them to yourself, and just be aware of them and change them for the good. This has been Understanding Money. I am Owen McGee. I would really appreciate, and as with the team here, we would love if you jumped on there and hit that follow button. When you follow us, it makes a difference to the algorithm or some of the stuff that works in the pack, and it pushes up the charts. And what that means is we can do bigger and better shows as we keep going. Thanks for listening. We all appreciate it. I appreciate it. This has been Understanding Money.